This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Well, thank you, Roger, and good morning to you and good morning to world as we come your way with our weekly visit here on the Saturday Morning Show. Lots of things to talk about this morning, and we're going to get to as many of them as we can. So we hope you'll stay with us. We'll talk markets with Paul Georgie of Allendale at McHenry, Illinois, and we'll talk World Dairy Expo and sort of sum up this year's activity and events at the Big Dairy Show in Madison. We'll be talking to Scott Bentley, who is the general manager of the World Dairy Show. But before we do all that, Jim Fazell going to talk about Halloween and things to do at farmers markets. But maybe even more important to you is how to keep bugs out of the house, because they try to get in and stay in warmer weather during the winter season. So we'll be talking about all of that, and we'll join Jim when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Well, the season certainly is winding down for gardeners and lawn people and everybody else, but Jim Fazell still has some things to talk about, and we're going to do that this morning. And I understand the subject, Jim, is bugs?
Yes, you know, we talked about bugs getting in like spiders and ants some weeks ago, but there are things now that are beginning to become kind of pesty. And these are creatures that normally don't come indoors, and they don't eat indoors, but they will find some place to get indoors if they can, and they just spend the winter in with you. We're talking about box elder bugs, the Asian ladybugs, and a new one that's come on the scene is the brown marmorated squash bug.
The what?
First of all, the box elder bugs are these smaller red and black bugs. They feed on box elder trees in the summer, but they normally cluster under rocks and things like that for the winter. But they'll try to get indoors, and they cluster on the side of a house where they're in the sun, and they get kind of deep there, maybe two or three insects deep in big clusters, and they wander around. That's how they get indoors. They won't hurt anything. You can vacuum them up indoors if you'd like. They're not going to bite. They're just a nuisance. Asian ladybugs. These are these larger ladybugs, multicolored, that were imported to control corn aphids many years ago. They have the same habit of clustering on the sunny sides of buildings and will wander indoors. They don't bite, but they may pinch. People think it's a bite. Well, it kind of is, but it's not going to injure anything. They don't eat anything indoors. They're just in there to spend the winter. And my inclination is leave them alone. And they get into our house once in a while, and if you don't do anything with them, they eventually disappear. You don't know where they are, but they're spending the winter. Then in spring, you're going to see them come back out again, and they'll try to find a way out, and that's the time to put them outdoors. They are beneficial. You don't want to kill them if you can avoid that. Now, this brown marmorated squash bug is a new creature that's moved into this area. It severely damages cucurbit, squash, and pumpkins and so forth in the garden. It's a shield-shaped insect about half to three-quarters of an inch long and wide. They're in there just to seek shelter. They, too, do not bite. But you don't want to do anything with them that will squash them, because they are stink bugs, and I mean they smell kind of bad. So if they get indoors, the best thing to do with them is to vacuum them up. These are not beneficial creatures that you want to save, like with the ladybugs. So vacuuming them up and getting rid of them is the best thing to do with them. Now, I want to talk a little bit about pumpkins.
It's time.
Yeah, it is. It is a great time, and there are a lot of them out there, and I'm really surprised with the weather that we had, that the growers did such a good job of producing them. The roadside stands and the farmers markets are featuring pumpkins right now, and of course, every year I get people asking me. I would think that after so many years of us talking about it, there wouldn't be anybody out there that would have a question like this, or questions like these, but one is that, is this a fruit or a vegetable? And the answer is yes. It's the fruit of a vine plant, but it's used as a vegetable. And then, is it a pumpkin or a squash? Well, pumpkins are squash vine plants. They just happen to be one of the species of squash that we grow as a pumpkin. We have summer squash that are things like the zucchini, straight neck squash, and so forth. We have standard orange pumpkins like the New England pie and the Howden Field. These don't happen to be orange. They're brown. These are the ones that are grown for canning pumpkin. And then we have winter squash. Now, the pumpkins that we use for jack-o'-lanterns are both of the orange pumpkin type and of the winter squash type. They're grown specifically for that, the orange pumpkins. They're not generally used for canning or anything, although if you do have an orange pumpkin that you don't carve, these can be used for making pumpkin pie or for making pumpkin pudding that you can freeze or can to keep for the middle of winter when you want a pumpkin pie. The giant pumpkin contest is where we find a difference between the squash and the pumpkin as far as their terms are concerned. Giant pumpkins are a particular species of pumpkin. There are a couple of them that are grown just for their huge size. And here in Illinois, I think the record is somewhere around 1,000 pounds for one of these things. But I just saw recently that the record out in California was over a ton. I don't know how you would do that, but they have a lot longer growing season there. First of all, I don't know how you'd move the thing to weigh it, but that's what the giant pumpkins are. Just a little bit of information about the commercial pumpkins. The state of Illinois grows about 95% of all the canning pumpkin, that's the brownish colored one, grown in the United States. They're grown down along the Illinois River. If you've been down there and looked out in the field, it looked like there were big footballs out there. That's what these things look like when they're ready to harvest. They harvest something around 100,000 tons of these each year down there, the Dixon Field and the Buckskin Pumpkins. Very interesting that would be a product or a crop that we grow here in Illinois, but it's not grown very, very much in any other place. Our climate's just right for it, and our farmers down there know how to grow it like nobody else. The soils are great, and they have plenty of moisture at the right time of year to grow these, and that's what makes it such an important crop down there. Now let's talk a little bit about the other pumpkins that we have that we use for ornamental pumpkins. We have a variety of pumpkin that turns white. It's grown white, that's the way it is. You don't have to paint it, but you can paint different colors over this. You can carve these pumpkins if you want to, but generally they're used for painting, because this white color of them is a good background for that. And incidentally, while we're talking about the pumpkin farms, get out and see one of these places or visit one of these places. This would be a good weekend to do that, or that we still have next weekend that you can do that before Halloween. The bigger pumpkin farms are featuring things like special events. They have haunted houses, pony rides, petting zoos, and of course most of them have cider and donuts that you can get to while the kids are having fun. You can sit down and have a donut and some cider. Also at the pumpkin farms, they still have things like apples. A lot of them carry stuff year-round because they are farmers markets as well. And they have a lot of things that you can use for storage over the wintertime, like potatoes and onions. There are other items that most of these carry, like honey and cheese. Some of them have mushrooms and jams and jellies and a lot of baked goods. Anyway, that's something that you want to do when you go out to get your pumpkins, that look at some of the other things they have. And most of them have stuff that you might need for winterizing your garden. Anyway, we're going to run out of time this week because it's a busy week. Next week, we're going to finish up the garden. That will be the last broadcast, regular broadcast of the year. And those of you who are struggling with what to do to get your garden put to bed, give a listen next week, and we'll give you some real good hints on what to do.
And I do have to mention, talking about going out to farmers markets, night before last, we drove on Highway 47 past the Gobert Farm, and of course, that's just 2 or 3 miles away from where we live in Huntley. They are doing a light show this year. And wow. As you drive by in the evening, it is brilliant and fun to see. So, you know, that's just one of the attractions in addition to buying the pumpkin that you can do at farmers markets. So we'll look forward to wrapping up the garden season next week and another visit with Jim Fizell here on the Saturday Morning Show. The 2018 World Dairy Expo is history, but it's fun to look back after we've been able to sort of analyze everything that happened, and so we're going to do that now with Scott Bentley, who is general manager of World Dairy Expo at Madison, Wisconsin. And I think we'll start with the numbers, Scott. How did they look this year on cows, people, and exhibitors?
Well, our attendance in 2018 was similar to 2017. We had 65,000 attendees, including 2,379 international attendees from 94 different countries. So we were down about 3,000 attendees from the 2017 show, but in line with our expectations. Some additional information for your listeners. We had 890 exhibiting or participating companies from 30 countries, 6 Canadian provinces, and 44 states in our trade show, so we were thrilled with that. And that included 99 new participating companies, so it's always positive and healthy to interject new commercial exhibitors into the trade show experience. And in our dairy cattle show, we had 2,338 head exhibiting from 1,779 different dairy cattle exhibitors from 37 states and 8 Canadian provinces. So we were thrilled with the overall participation at the 2018 World Dairy Expo.
When you say 94 countries, what countries would be the leaders from the standpoint of attendance?
Well, certainly Canada and Mexico are always going to be right at the top, and I think those are obvious countries participating. Also in the top five this year were Japan and Colombia and the Netherlands, who will perennially rank quite high in our international audience. So we were down about 400 international attendees from 2017. I think there's some factors in play that might have impacted overall attendance. One area where we were down a bit from 2017 was China, as an example, who has become one of our top five countries in terms of international participation, but was not quite that high in 2018.
And a question I have to ask, anybody from Cuba come to the World Dairy Expo?
You know, I wish I could answer that question. I don't know for sure if that's one of our 94 countries, but obviously, you know, when you have nearly 100 countries participating, that's a very high percentage of the overall global dairy audience, and a pretty good chance. We'll find out after the show.
Certainly the world title does apply to World Dairy Expo. 99 new exhibitors. Was that basically technology or equipment or what?
Well, what we do on an annual basis is we reevaluate our trade show. There's some companies that want to get larger with their space, some that are consolidating and moving away from the trade show. So we want to ensure that we have new companies participating, bringing their latest innovation and technologies to the trade show floor. And so we closely scrutinize those new companies to ensure that they're bringing something new and different and that will add value to our dairy producers that are in attendance.
And because of the concern over disease problems, one of the big changes you've made over the years, instead of going out and visiting actual dairy farms, now you hold virtual dairy farm tours, and I would guess you did quite a few of them this year.
We did. We have, on an annual basis, we have 8 virtual farm tours, which means we bring the farm experience to the World Dairy Expo grounds. Instead of traversing out in the countryside to evaluate dairy farms and learn what they're doing that's new and different and bringing value to their operations, we bring that to World Dairy Expo via video and certainly via PowerPoint presentations. Those are very interactive, very informative, and very much a part of the World Dairy Expo experience today.
What did you hear from the dairy farmers? Because we hear so much doom and gloom, but apparently they're still coming out and looking.
Well, you know, it's a challenging time in the dairy industry, not just in the United States, but globally. But I'll tell you, we did not have some of those feelings on display on the grounds. We had a very positive environment. We had folks who were coming from all over North America and all over the world coming together, wanting to get away from some of the challenges in their home operations. There was a sense of optimism, a sense of teamwork and collaboration. And certainly it's an opportunity for folks to network, to socialize, and really leave some of those challenges behind for a week. And that's what they did at the Expo.
And you've picked the dates for the 2019 edition about the same time in October?
We have. It will be October 1st through the 5th, 2019, same time, same place, on the Alliant Energy Center grounds in Madison, Wisconsin.
And then the question I always ask, and the one that you'll never answer, what color will the shavings in the show ring be next year?
Well, I can tell you this much. If your listeners listen approximately a year from now, we'll certainly share that information. That's one of the fun secrets of being a staff member. We'll select the shavings color to align with the theme and something that displays the world-class dairy cattle most prominently on the tan bark. And we'll make that decision in the coming weeks.
And I never figured out what color it was this year. I don't know what color you would call it.
Well, we actually called it a Sedona Red, I believe, was the technical color of the dyed shavings. It's quite a process because, you know, we have tons of shavings, and we need to get those samples dyed in advance and then dried in advance so we can see what they actually look like. But it went along with our theme of the next frontier and color matched, I think, quite well, not only in the show ring but throughout the grounds as well.
Well, thank you as always for your hospitality, and we look forward to the first week of October 2019. A visit with Scott Bentley, who is General Manager of World Dairy Expo, Madison, Wisconsin. And we're at 25 minutes before 6 o'clock. Thank you very much, Roger. And we're going to talk markets with Paul Giorgi of Allendale, based in McHenry, Illinois, in a few minutes here on the Saturday Morning Show. But before that, we say welcome to Samuelson Says. It's brought to you by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. And I am Orion, this week asking the question, what has happened to respect and civility? I'm just delighted to be on the air for Wink Products Company, one of those Midwest success stories. Wink is a family-owned corporation in rural Eldora, Iowa, that has manufactured specialty cleaning products for 71 years. And today, Wink is a nationally recognized brand because Wink products work. Wink manufactures professional-strength household cleaners and drain openers for you. Learn about all of the Wink products at wink.com. W-H-I-N-K. 20 years ago, someone wrote a death notice entitled The Death of Common Sense in the United States, concerned about the fact that we seem to have lost all common sense. But I think now we should rewrite that death notice and entitle it The Death of Civility and Respect in the United States. All you need do is look at the commercials ahead of the midterm election. Do you see any of them being positive or informative about the candidate's ability to improve our current situation? I only see those that attack the opponent and talk about how bad and how little he knows about what to do to solve some of our problems today. Negative commercials, and I'm joined by many people who say they are tired of negative political campaign commercials. But the sad news, surveys prove the negative commercial does work. And now, after watching activity on Capitol Hill in marches of protest and in parades and all of the other activities, it's becoming more apparent to me that the point is, don't listen to what other people say, just yell loudly enough so you can't hear the other side, and we will just keep attacking. A lot of problems with that, but one of them to me is the fact we're going to get to the point where we will not get qualified candidates for office because of all the nasty personal attacks that take place. About 10 years ago, I was considered for a few days to be a candidate for the U.S. Senate in Illinois, and I was thinking about it. But can you guess who said no? My wife Gloria said, no, I do not want you involved in political campaigns. And until things change, until we bring some civility and respect back for opinions other than ours, I'm afraid not much else will change. My thoughts on Samuelson Says. A presentation of Tribune Radio Networks. It was a tumultuous time in the stock market this week, not quite as tumultuous in the agricultural markets this week. But we're going to talk about current activities and sitting down with Max Armstrong in our studio, Paul Georgi of Allendale, based in McHenry, Illinois. That's coming up when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show.
Paul Georgi is our guest this weekend to talk about the markets from Allendale Incorporated. There just isn't much happening. Well, we did see a little bump or two here during the week. Beans showed a little bit of life. What was that about?
Well, I think it's as one of my customers best describes it, it rallied because it can. Because if you look at all the fundamentals, you can argue one day one way, the next day the opposite way. So I think that day when we get a nice rally out of these things, it's because we got a lot of equity moving into the market, fund buying, and it could have easily been caused because the stock market moved lower. We moved some money out of the or into the commodities and caused some buying to take effect there.
There was also that confirmation of a very slow soybean harvest. We were reminded of that, of what was happening west of the Mississippi River, even though I think farmers are picking up the pace, certainly have this week.
I think this week's pace is going to be good. But you got to look at the whole picture, though. We're still probably going to be less than 50% harvested on soybeans at a time where we should be much greater than that. We should be 60, 70% done. So that, I think, is going to continue to provide some underlying support for soybeans, although when we get clear skies, there's going to be harvesting done, and that's going to pressure the market because we really don't have anything that will support us right now. Tariff situation, the trade situation between all the different countries that we're negotiating with right now, that is still not clear. So those talks, one day you get comments from one country or another, it can provide some support. But otherwise, we're just kind of in a tug of war at this point in time.
Back on that crop for a moment. Here toward the end of the week, as we saw combines moving through the fields that could not be entered a few days ago, you saw dust flying. But, boy, those shots of snow in soybean fields early in the week, about a week ago, those were ugly. Did we lose some crop because of that?
I think there's no question. We have lost some crop because of the rains, the snow. My guys in the Dakotas, where they had a lot of snow, they're not too worried about it. But I think the heavy rain that we've seen across Iowa, southern Minnesota, there's definitely some loss there. I mean, on social media, you see all these pictures of beans popping out of the pods. That's certainly some of that happening.
Beans sprouting also.
Beans sprouting. Quality is going to be an issue, I think. So all of those, we have lost some. The question is how much.
The condition rating overall on the soybean crop, I noticed, I believe, in this past week's crop bulletin, didn't change much. I was a little bit surprised. I thought they would have downgraded the condition some, given the fact that those fields in the wintry weather and the heavy rains were battered so badly.
Well, normally you should see that. I mean, we should see crop conditions go down. The crop condition report throughout the year is kind of a beauty contest anyway, and we're at the, let's say we're reaching the end of the runway here where the crop doesn't look quite as good. And, you know, so you should see some downgrade. I don't think crop conditions mean too much anymore. The producers want to get in the field. They want to get these things harvested. And I think they're definitely picking up pace. And the weather seems to be open for the 10 days in here. There should be a lot of beans harvested.
What are you hearing from out at the elevators? Have many of them started to run out of space, especially in the eastern Corn Belt areas where the harvest has been most rapid? Illinois, Indiana?
Well, I think I haven't heard anything specifically at the elevator. The only thing that you can look at there is you look at basis, and basis is extremely wide. And the guys in Iowa and Dakotas, I mean, North Dakota, we've got soybean basis there of nearly $2, $1.60, $70, $80. You got corn basis at $1 plus. Those are the things that are telling me that the elevators don't want them. So we're looking and telling our clients that, you know, if you can find a way to hold this grain, it probably is the wisest thing just for the basis appreciation. I mean, historically, the best basis comes to us in around the first week in December. And the reason that is harvest is done. Farmers have got a crop put into place, stored where they want to store it, and nobody wants to sell it until after the first of the year. So if you can find a place to store
will that work this year?
I think it will. I mean, it does every year because there won't be any corn, there won't be any sales. The question is how much will it improve? But it's got to improve more than where we're at today. So I think that would be certainly an option. Now, we're hearing some concerns about the quality of the crop. There's some problems in corn because of the wetness. Some varieties are showing some issues with quality. Soybeans, we're hearing quality problems there. If that continues, I mean, you almost have to get rid of it now, and that's going to definitely hurt the farmer's bottom line.
To switch a little bit, looking at South America, they're in the progress of planting crops, big crops down there, expected to be record crops. A little bit of dryness has been reported in recent days, we understand, in parts of Brazil, but it's nothing too worrisome, I guess, at this point, is it?
No, the weather reports that we're getting, the conditions are improving. A lot of the area is getting some good moisture in Argentina and Brazil. The crop is going in the ground. They're going to plant more acres, possibly 3% more acres than they did last year. And the amazing thing is when you look at their planting progress, they're getting it in faster than they did last year, which means that will narrow that door of opportunity for the U.S. soybeans to be exported to China and other places because South American harvest will probably be a little bit earlier.
And that would lead to perhaps more corn being planted down there in that Safrinha crop, would it not?
It could. We could see more corn planted in Brazil. The other thing is we're going to see a lot more corn planted in Argentina and potentially a much bigger crop there because last year they had a drought. So you say, well, what are we going to look for opportunity for U.S. prices? You know, sad to say, but we got to look for some problems somewhere else in the world to get that world buyer to come to the U.S. and get rid of some of these large inventories that we have.
The trade issue is still the issue, isn't it?
Trade is an issue. It may not be as much of an issue as we think because we have got such a large crop. So that's kind of it's been the double whammy on us. But trade is important. We need to export grain to get rid of some of these oversupplies that we've got. We need to export soybeans or meal or some products to get rid of the inventory. The corn, on the other hand, I mean, we're stocks to usage ratios in corn in the U.S. is the tightest we've seen in 5 years, mm-hmm. even with the large crop. So there is demand. If we would see a hiccup in corn quality, let's say, and you look at and the USDA changed these numbers around a little bit, we could see some good support come in the corn prices simply for that reason.
There's not that much wiggle room, then, you're saying, as far as the corn balance sheet is concerned.
Corn balance sheet has it's very much constructive compared to soybeans.
Right.
And, you know, so there is some hope there. But the problem is we have tremendous supply. We've got competition from wheat. That's another factor that will keep the corn in balance. And now there's a lot of people in the trade and looking at the potential supply of Russian wheat and EU wheat that they think is a lot smaller than what's being reported now. And that could come to support wheat prices and in turn help us in corn down the road. But it may not be here for a couple months.
You mentioned a little bit earlier what had happened to the equity markets with that sell-off on Wall Street. We do see those from time to time, but boy, they're just not very very lengthy, those sessions where they beat back the equities. But if that were to happen, if we were, and there are some people saying, oh, you know, the stocks have gotten so high here, the run is just about over, will we see a little more money then coming into the agriculture commodities if folks are bailing out of Wall Street stocks?
Well, I think it's a fine line or a very a balanced beam that we walk across here, because if the stock market breaks too much, then you'll see money come out of everything and take it to the sideline and try to the investors pull their money back, find out what they got, and then they'll reinvest. But if we just get little setbacks like we've had in the equity markets, then people move money around and they're going to move it into commodities because they're cheap. So they try to find, we'll take some out of the equity markets, put it into a market that gives us more opportunity just simply because it's cheap. And I think that's where in the last few weeks, you know, we've rallied the corn market nearly 50 cents and nearly 75 to a dollar in soybeans. And a lot of that is simply because of money moving around more than, you know, a fundamental factor.
When there is that kind of a price move in the ag commodities, what are you telling your producers they should be doing?
Well, I think what we've got right now, where we've seen this nice rally, you have to take advantage of it. I think when a producer has got to look seriously at his bottom line, at his profitability, and when you look at the size of the crop that we've got right now and you get a pop in the market here, there's many cases where you are at break even or above, and you just need to take some action. And there's all kinds of ways to do it. You know, rather than just going out and selling the grain, maybe you need to use some option strategies to protect yourself on the downside or the upside, depending on your own situation. It also, if we're staying in a trading range, there's option strategies that you can do there with limited margin risk and limited risk in these things, and then sell the grain. Put the money in the bank, because what we're hearing also, Max, is that there's a lot of, you know, there could be some tough situation come December, January, when notes have to be renewed.
Some serious banker discussions.
There is some very serious banker discussions. I was talking to one, had dinner with one here last week, and he was concerned. And well, he wouldn't tell me exactly what the situation was, but he says there's a lot of loans that are probably not going to be renewed this year. So that's just an indication that there is. It's a tough situation out there. There's no question about it.
We're hearing that rumble more and more, it seems. Paul, thank you for coming in with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Paul Georgie with Allendale Incorporated.
We're just 3 minutes away from news time here on WGN Radio Chicago. I do want to mention the fact that the monthly cattle on feed report released yesterday by the Department of Agriculture maybe had some small surprises. The report showed 11,400,000 cattle in feedlots as of the 1st of October. That's about 5% more than a year ago, and the most ever in the data series that started back in 1996. But it was still slightly less than expectations, for an increase of 6.4%. And some 2,051,000 cattle were placed on feed in feedlots in September. That's down 5% from last year, and traders anticipated that number would be just slightly higher. So the smaller number could boost cattle futures on Monday, even if overall cattle supplies remain ample. Rich Nelson, analyst with Allendale, said, "This is a surprise and we have to treat it as such. The September, October, November period is the biggest placement push for the whole year, and the first month gives us some question about spring supplies." But Rich went on to say, "I don't know if it shakes up the fact that we will still have a heavy summer supply of beef in 2019. So as we look ahead to the week coming up, where are we going to start with prices? In livestock trade, yesterday we ended with October feeder cattle up or down 85 cents at $112.22 a hundredweight. October or November now, feeder cattle down 15 cents at $154.27. And the February lean hog contract down $1.22 yesterday, $59.02 a hundredweight. The grain market yesterday at the Board of Trade, the December wheat contract up 0.75 cents, and it'll start trade next Monday at 5.13¾ cents a bushel. December corn down 4.5 cents for the day yesterday at 3.66¼. November soybeans down 7¼ cents. And that contract will start Monday at $8.56¼ a bushel. Well, we're about out of time here on the Saturday morning show. Thanks to Bob Ferguson, our engineer, who does all of the work. I just sit here and talk. And thanks to all of you for joining us and listening every week here on the Saturday morning show.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.